It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, he dropped out of the presidential race, but he still has a lot to say about the American political system. We'll talk to Lawrence Lessig.
First, an open government group filed a complaint yesterday alleging the Public Records Board changed the definition of transitory records in violation of Wisconsin's open meetings law.
Bill Leaders is the head of the group that filed that complaint. He's here with us in the studio to explain why they filed it. He's president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council. Bill, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here.
It sounds like there are two main issues here, what the changes were and how they were put into place. Let's
exactly.
start with that second point, the how. You have concerns that this is in violation of the state's open meetings law.
Yeah, our open meetings law says that when a public body takes an action, they're supposed to identify what that action is on a notice, put it on their agenda, which is released in advance. In this case, you would never know from looking at the agenda that was put out for the August meeting of the Public Records Board that they were going to make what would prove to be a significant change in the definition of what a transitory, as they call it, record is. And that change has been used to deny access to records that once would have been released. So because they did not properly notice their intention to change the definition of this category of records, we have asked the district attorney of Dane County to bring an enforcement action under our open meetings law.
And the response from the Public Records Board has been this was such a minor, insignificant procedural kind of change, a clarification, that it didn't rise to the level that needs to be on an agenda. And that takes us to part two. You object to the changes themselves. You say this is not insignificant. So what changes happen as a result of this action by the Public Records Board?
Well, I think the changes on their face are significant. What it did is it expanded the definition of transitory record to include some things like, you know, emails of routine scheduling, and it would include training videos that are made. It would say that these are records that you no longer have to keep. And I think that's a significant change. It is true, though, that the interpretation that's been put on this change by people in the Walker administration may be broader than what the board intended. It has been used already to deny access to text messages that were sent between state officials and one of the companies that received money from the Economic Development Corporation of Wisconsin, and then, you know, basically took the money and ran. And it's been used to deny access to visitor logs at the executive residence when those are requested. The government now says, oh, these are transitory records. We don't have to release them. We can destroy them at will.
Right. It's not even denying access. They, as far as we've heard in those requests, don't exist anymore.
That's it.
Let's talk about that concrete example of the texts. You can see examples where something maybe should be considered a transitory record. What room's the meeting in? Or two officials saying, how about that Packer game last night? That kind of stuff, can they just delete? Should they be able to just delete that because that's of no interest to a journalist down the road? Or is even that
well, you know,
record?
I've made records requests, and I've received lots of, material that is not that scintillating. It's mm-hmm. just run-of-the-mill stuff. You know, can we meet now? Can we meet then? And that's really part of you know, the bulk of records requests. I don't see why you need to just say that if it falls into that category of minimal relevance that you can destroy it. I think that, you know, first of all, who knows whether something is destroyed is relevant or not after it's been destroyed. So I question the wisdom of allowing this.
Talking to Bill Leaders with the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council about changes to Wisconsin's records guidelines, things between public officials. What do they have to keep? How long do they have to keep it? He says the way that was changed also violates open meetings laws in the state. So, Bill, I mean, one concern is if we got to save every single little thing in the age of electronic communication, we end up with huge nightmare of archives, so much stuff. How can anybody keep track of it? Where do we store it? How do we sort through it when we get that open records request?
Yeah, it is an issue, but it's a manageable issue. It's one that local governments have found ways to address. And I think, you know, within state government, there are agencies, and even the governor says, you know, he always archives his text messages by sending them to his email so that they can be preserved. It doesn't seem to present a huge problem for our governor, for some state agencies, and for some local governments that have found ways to save these. Now, you don't necessarily need to save them forever, but there should be some reasonable retention requirement for all communications made by government officials about the public's business.
How might this have gone differently if this Public Records Board had followed the open meetings law, as you're saying they should have done?
Well, it's possible. In fact, if they do it now, with all of the reaction that this has gotten because of the way it's been applied, it will be a meeting that is attended probably for the first time in this board's history. There will be public interest in what it does, and there'll be public members of the public that want to see how it operates. Certainly there are members of the public like myself who would want to have input into the crafting of any changes in the language.
Now, as I understand it, this change happened back in August. Why are we just seeing this complaint this week?
Well, a couple things. They did cite it way back in August, but the Wisconsin State Journal, who received one of the denials citing this authority, did not come out with a story until just recently after the denial was made. The denial wasn't made right away, and then it took a while for the story to get written. And then this issue with being used to deny access to logs of the visitor's residence has also happened sometime after when the change was made.
So let's talk about the paper side. I've focused a lot on the text and the electronic communications. There was a written record in the case of the executive residence, right? The log, who's come in to visit today.
Yeah. They do keep a log, obviously, of who visits the governor, and you'd think that they would hold on to it for a good long time because of its obvious importance, both for security reasons and historical reasons. But what they said when a group requested it is, we have it for a couple of months. Here you go. Beyond that, you ask for it for more than these couple of months, for a longer period. We don't have them at all. We don't have to keep them. These are transitory records. We can just destroy them. Bad public policy, first of all. People should not be able to come and go to the visit with the governor at his residence that the citizens of Wisconsin are paying for, and then have all trace of their visit disappeared because someone feels that they don't have to hold on to the record.
Within a state agency, who's the decider of what gets kept or not? If I'm, say, a state official, I send a text related to work. Is there somebody, an office, that I forward that to and say, hey, decide whether this gets logged or not, or is it just up to me to hit delete or not?
Some agencies do that, have designated records custodians and keepers, you know, people whose job it would be to manage the technical end and to make the policy decisions of what needs to be saved.
What's the next step for this complaint, this open records challenge?
The District Attorney of Dane County has 20 working days to bring an action against the Public Records Board if he agrees that the law was not followed in the changing of this language. And failing that, then it would be possible for my group or someone else to bring an action against the board in the courts.
I want to end, Bill, by asking what's at stake here. Somebody in the public might be thinking, oh, you know, it doesn't sound like these texts are important. These logs are that important. We're not really losing that much if the press doesn't have access to them. So what?
I don't think people feel that way. I think when you come down to these two particular examples, people feel quite the opposite. When you tell people that they destroyed records of who's visited the governor, or that they destroyed text messages that have to do with people who come to the government hat in hand and get government handouts on the public dime, I think people do care.
Bill, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Bill Leaders, president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council. He was with us to explain why his group filed a complaint yesterday alleging the Public Records Board violated state open meetings laws. He's not running for president anymore, but he still has plenty to say about the American political system. Lawrence Lessig is a Harvard law professor and author of the book Republic Lost.
He's a former candidate for the 2016 Democratic presidential nomination and ran on a platform of eliminating the influence of money in politics. Lawrence Lessig joins us now. Lawrence, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you make a distinction between a corrupt person, who we might say consider a criminal, and a corrupt institution. What's the difference?
Well, you know, a corrupt institution is one that has let itself become susceptible to influences that drive it away from its purpose. So think about Congress. Congress was supposed to be representative, dependent on, as Madison said, the people alone. But because of the way we fund campaigns, and because members of Congress spend anywhere between 30% and 70% of their time raising money to fund their campaigns, they've increasingly become dependent on funders as well as on the people. So that corrupts the basic purpose of a representative democracy when they are dependent on people that don't represent us. And that's a corrupt institution, even if all of them, were perfectly honorable people, never engaged in any bribery and any other criminal activity.
Well, and how do you see that playing out in what happens, what gets passed, and how American politics functions today?
Well, the most important thing it does is shift the priorities of what Congress cares about. Because, you know, if you spend 30 to 70% of your time dialing for dollars, you become incredibly sensitive, aware of the interests of the people who you're dialing for dollars from. And it turns out, obviously, they're not randomly dialing the telephone. What they're doing is calling a very, very tiny slice of the 1% who have very specific interests, very specific needs which they need served. And that begins to shift what Congress does. So, for example, in the first quarter of 2011, if you had said, what was the number one thing Congress spent its time working on? You know, we're in the middle of two wars. There's a huge budget deficit. They're about to shut down the government because of the debt ceiling. We hadn't done anything on climate change. There was a whole bunch of stuff with Obamacare that was still being worked out. The number one thing Congress worked on, both in the committees and on the floor of Congress, was something called the bank swipe fee controversy. And what that means is when you use your debit card, how much is charged to the retailer, and how much does the bank therefore get to collect? Now, that was the number one thing Congress spent its time working on, not because anybody went to Washington with concern of taking on the bank swipe fee issue. It was because when they would dance one way or the other, millions of dollars would be rained down upon Congress from the various interests who would benefit or be hurt by it based on what Congress does. So they begin to bend over backwards to make it easier to raise money rather than doing what they're supposed to be doing, which is answering what ordinary people want them to do.
So you're saying the agenda changes based on where this money comes from, and you also use the term bending a couple of times. Do you think that this bending toward the particular interests of money coming in, does that happen in an unconscious way, or is it something that's a more deliberate kind of congressional malpractice, say?
No, I think increasingly it is unconscious. You know, if you think about ordinary humans, and that's what they at least are. These members of Congress are at least ordinary humans. You know, when you're so socialized, so routinized in paying attention to how you're going to be raising this money, you become incredibly vulnerable to the suggestions and the directions of people who are signaling to you what you need to do to be able to raise money. You know, much of this money comes through lobbyists, not themselves giving money, but channeling money from their corporate clients. And in that process, you become dependent on these lobbyists, and that dependence, becomes a natural thing for you. They give you favors. If you're human, in response to favors, you give favors. You give favors back.
Isn't it naive to assume that, in some sense, if we go back to, say, our founding fathers, that there were no special interests, even if it wasn't to the extent that we have it today? Weren't there always special interests?
Of course there were. Of course there were. And in fact, one of the things Madison, they thought they were doing was setting up a government that could neutralize the special interests. So there's always been money. There's always been special interests. But there's never been, in 100 years in America, the kind of concentration of funding that we see today. And we've not had, in the context of Congress, such an incredibly corrupted and crippled institution, completely incapable of addressing the core problems that we have as a nation, because it's so bent over backwards in the face of its funders and because of the incredible polarization that the way we fund campaigns helps to exacerbate. So what, you know, we need to be able to step back and say, look, it's not that we've ever had a pure time, but we have had times when government could actually work. It could actually function. And we've moved into a time where it is so dependent on these special interests, these funding interests, you know, what conservatives call crony capitalism, liberals call these special interests, whatever you want to call it, that it cannot function to do the job it needs to do, regardless of who's in power. You know, this is not a Republican-Democratic thing. It's a point about the institution itself that needs to be reformed.
Now, use the phrase again, concentration of funding. Describe that for us. How concentrated is that?
Well, you know, in this election cycle, 158 families have given half the money that's been contributed to the presidential candidates and their super PACs. 158 families. If you think about the total number of people who in the last election cycle gave the maximum amount allowed to just one candidate, that number is about 0.02% of America, no more than 50,000 Americans, right? So the point is, this is a system where to fund your campaigns, we are turning to an ever smaller number of people. And as you turn to a smaller number of people, those people themselves have an increasing amount of influence in the system. And again, it's not an influence necessarily to the left or an influence to the right. What increasingly it is an influence to basically block the government from doing anything. Francis Fukuyama says we've become a vetoocracy, a vetocracy. And by that he means that because there's such concentrated, powerful interests here, it's always possible for someone to exercise their power to block change or to block any improvement because it will benefit them to stop the improvement, even if it hurts all of us for that improvement to be stopped.
We're talking with Lawrence Lessig right now, professor of law at Harvard, author of Republic Lost, and also a former candidate for the 2016 Democratic nomination for president. And CNN is slated to host its final GOP primary debate of 2015 tonight. Is campaign reform on anybody's top 10 list right now, Republicans or Democrats?
Yeah, well, that's really great question. You know, YouGov did a poll in Iowa and among Democratic Party voters and asked if the next president could do just one thing, what should it be? And the number one answer was to fix this corrupted system of funding campaigns above every other, you know, standard issue, the wealth, minimum wage or health care or even ISIS at that time. But the candidates don't want to talk about this, and they don't want to talk about this on the Republican side because it feels a little bit like hypocrisy. I mean, that's what Donald Trump was trading on when Donald Trump made this such a central issue on the second Republican debate. And he said, you know, basically, I own all of you guys. I own Hillary Clinton, too. You know, he could say that because he wasn't depending on this outside money to fund his campaigns, but everybody else was. And on the Democratic side, Democrats have actually all committed deep in their platforms to really important fundamental change. But none of them are really talking about that change. The idea of changing the way campaigns are funded was not mentioned by any Democratic candidate in any of these debates so far. So the politicians don't raise this issue or talk about it. And what that means is ordinary people who, you know, understand the problem and think the system is corrupt, don't actually see a way to fix it because they're not being offered a way to fix it. And that's what leads many people to think that there's nothing we can do about it. We're basically stuck in this corrupted system and there's no way out.
Well, in 2002, there was bipartisan support for campaign finance reform with legislation from John McCain and Russ Feingold. That got rolled back in part in 2010. And then we had Citizens United, that decision, which removed restrictions from corporations on campaign spending. So what's changed, do you think, in the country since 2002 when there was pretty broad bipartisan support for campaign finance reform?
Yeah, I think the problem we've had with reform so far is we tried to do reform on the cheap. You know, the 2002 reform was basically trying to suppress the ability of different groups to spend their money. And that technique, you know, has been the standard technique for the last 30 years. I think we should learn it just won't work. It won't be allowed constitutionally. The Supreme Court has been striking example after example of that kind of regulation down. But it also doesn't actually change the way the system is working, because even if you suppress the amount that's being spent, if you raise the amount you're spending from this tiny, tiny fraction of the 1%, there still will be this distorting, corrupting effect inside the system. So the only way to solve this problem is to change the way we're funding elections. There are a couple ways people are talking about it. Republicans are talking about the idea of giving everybody a voucher so that they could use a small voucher that would be a rebate of their taxes that they would use to give to candidates who fund their campaigns with small dollar contributions. Democrats have talked about matching contributions, so if you give a small contribution, it gets matched by the government. But either of these two ideas would have the same effect. It would radically change the way we raise money. We would not raise money from this tiny, tiny few, but instead would raise money from many, many people. And now that would cost something, but if you think about how much money the government spends on corporate welfare, which the Cato Institute, a libertarian think tank, estimates is about $100 billion a year, the cost, which would be, you know, probably $3 billion to run a system like that, is a fraction of the amount that would be saved just by liberating Congress from the need to return the favors to these corporate contributors.
Given the current political climate right now, how close do you think that we would be to any sort of reform like the one you describe?
Well, you know, so long as no presidential candidate is talking about the reform, it's not going to happen. And even if they did talk about the reform, it would be a hard thing to achieve just because lobbyists in Washington would fight it as strongly as they possibly could. Because if we change the way you fund campaigns, it would radically weaken the power of lobbyists and therefore make them not as rich as they are right now. So, you know, I think that what we're unfortunately is seeing an election cycle, which though this issue is at the top of what people are talking about and what frustrates them, and I think largely what explains the excitement that people feel around Donald Trump, that he's at least somebody different, not beholden to these interests. Even though that's true, we're not going to see it so far. It's not, it seems like it's not going to become a central issue to the way this campaign is ultimately decided.
Lawrence, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Lawrence Lessig, professor of law at Harvard, author of Republic Lost, and former candidate for the 2016 Democratic nomination for president.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. 2015 was a great year for music made by Wisconsin artists. Right now we're hearing a song from former Milwaukee band Pele.
And we want to hear from you. Do you have a favorite album or song from a Wisconsin artist, past or present? Did you have any new music discoveries this year? Were there any great live shows you went to here in the state? Call and share at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Here with us in the studio to share his picks for the best music to come out of our state this year is Scott Gordon, editor of Tone Madison, and our WPR colleague. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me. It's nice to be here.
Well, first of all, the song that we heard just now, tell us a little bit about that Pele reissue.
So that comes from the third album that band put out called Elephant, which was released in 1999. As you could hear from that, they were an instrumental rock band comprised of John Mueller, Chris Rosenow, and Matt Tennyson. And basically this year they played some reunion shows. I think it was, you know, mostly just kind of a one-off thing, but I got to see one of those shows and it was fantastic. And their label Polyvinyl did a reissue of this album for Record Store Day, you know, reissued it on vinyl and so forth. And it's really pretty flowing music, but when you listen to it, there's a lot of kind of tension and really interesting stuff going on. And as far as instrumental rock or post-rock or whatever you want to call it goes, this, you know, was definitely one of the more distinctive bands to come along.
And was this a band, I could see just from that clip I heard there, I'm not familiar with them, are they a big improvisational band or is this pretty composed? Is every show going to sound really different?
I think a lot of it is through composed in their case. I don't know if there's a lot of improvisation really going on. I know that both John Mueller, the drummer, and Chris Rosenow, the guitar player, do a lot of different solo stuff and collaborative stuff that maybe involves more improvisation or more kind of far out approaches. You know, they both do a lot of great stuff. Continue to, you know, long after this band kind of ceased to be a thing. So that's really cool.
All right, well, let's talk a little jazz right now. There have been some good jazz releases out of Wisconsin this year. What'd you find?
So, right across the street from where we are, at the UW-Madison School of Music, we have an accomplished jazz pianist named Johannes Wallman, and he directs the UW-Madison jazz program. And he actually released two albums this year. One was a big band album, and then the other one was called The Town Musicians, and he recorded it in kind of mostly a five-piece setup with some musicians that he knew during his time living in New York City. You know, in I think probably about a decade ago. And the trumpeter on that record is Russ Johnson, who actually lives in Milwaukee and teaches at UW-Parkside in Kenosha, but he still plays a lot in Chicago and New York. There's a lot of tracks on here that are fairly extended, you know, 7 minutes or longer, and really have a nice conversational flowing feel. Like, it's really, I really like how unhurried it is and how open it is and how much kind of interchange you get between the musicians.
Let's give a listen. Johannes Wallman, this song is called Concurrencies. I see what you mean about the kind of unhurried quality in that track.
Yeah, absolutely.
It feels really
kind of mellow to listen to. And it's, I didn't know that this was someone right across the street in Madison
yeah.
here.
Right, yeah. And like you said, there is kind of a mellow feel to some of it, but it definitely builds and gets into some interesting places.
All right, well, you've got another jazz one for us from an artist called David Cooper.
Yes, he's a trumpet player, and he's from Black Earth and teaches at UW-Platteville, actually. And he put out an album this year called The Journey, and it has a lot of song titles like Yield and Detour or whatever, because it was inspired by this cross-country trip that he went on and, you know, and other experiences in his life. And it just has a lot of finesse to it and really draws on a lot of different inspirations. You know, almost every track he kind of calls out a different song or artist who inspired it. I got to see him and his band play part of this record in Madison this year, not even having had much of a chance to check it out before the show, and I really enjoyed it.
Our first one was just across the street. This one's just down the street, the street being 151 over in Platteville. So here's David Cooper. There on the trumpet. I don't think of Wisconsin as a jazz state. We got some good stuff out there.
Yeah, you know, I mean, everywhere you look, there's definitely variety. You know, that's my favorite thing about following music around the state, and even just here in Madison, is just the sheer variety of genres and perspectives that people bring to them.
And getting a little more out there in the realm of jazz, tell us about another band that you want us to take a listen to, one called The Lovely Socialite.
Yeah, and their name actually used to be longer. They used to be called Lovely Socialite Mrs. Thomas W. Phipps, if I recall correctly. And everyone just called them Lovely Socialites. They finally just officially truncated it, which...
It's long for a marquee.
I think we all appreciate it. but they put out... They're a six-piece band with members that are split between Madison and Milwaukee and one in Ann Arbor. But it started in Madison, and... it's mostly younger guys who come from a formal background, you know, are really well-trained musicians, but also want a chance to stretch and experiment with their playing and with their compositions. One of the musicians, Brian Grimm, plays cello, but also plays a whole bunch of different Chinese string instruments that he's mastered over the years. And so on a lot of these songs, you hear these really sharp and unusual sounds that kind of cut through, you know, playing the role that, you know, usually a string instrument will be playing, but just with a really different kind of timbre to it.
Here's a lovely socialite. That's Wisconsin band Lovely Socialite, as we talk about some of the best music out of Wisconsin in 2015 with our own Scott Gordon. Let's move on from the jazz world. We're going to get into some hip-hop now, I think. What do you got for us in Wisconsin's hip-hop world?
Well, the interesting thing was that there's a lot of good stuff that came out of from younger artists, you know, people in their teens or early 20s really making good stuff and kind of emerging in these really like mature kind of charismatic ways. One track that I think we have queued up is from Webster X, who's an MC from Milwaukee, and one of the things he released this year was this song Doomsday, and it was actually produced by a producer from Madison named Chance, so kind of a nice cross state somewhat collaboration. And I enjoy the production on this track a lot, but sort of the kind of the rhythm of the delivery that Webster X is using is really cool here, because it's a little slower, but he still keeps some kind of suspense and some momentum going into it.
All right, well, let's take a listen to that one.
In the palm of my hands, young Houdini, patch the pitfall, patch routine, daily questions, is it routine or buffet? Or they just too drink me? Hold up now, you a scheme man. I don't spaz out when I see these greens. Only spaz out when the jazz reach loud and the whole damn crowd looks at him like, wow, now. Been about
the game, whole cow. Invest the best dress, sex in the text, we so cow.
And a clip there from Doomsday by Webster X. It was interesting you said there's a cross collaboration that caught your eye. Is that unusual? Do people usually work around the state when it comes to their scene?
Oh, I mean, sometimes. Well, and especially in hip hop and electronic music, you know, people are, you know, will collaborate with people across the world, or at great distances. It's just such an easy thing to do now. I thought that was cool. It would be fun to see more of those things kind of happening among people working in the state, for sure.
While we're on the hip hop theme, we got a tweet from Andrew recommending the artist Trapo. Now, this is one I think on your list. Trapo from Madison.
Yeah, and I think I can guess who Andrew is, but Trapo is a 17-year-old guy from Madison, and a few weeks ago he released his first EP, and it's called the Black Beverly Hills EP. And the really striking things about this guy are that he can put together good songs, but he has a voice that sounds kind of a lot older than you'd expect to, a lot more kind of deep and rugged than you'd expect to from a 17-year-old. And there's kind of a conceptual arc to this EP that's actually really mature and really kind of has kept me coming back to it.
Okay, we've got a little bit of that. Let's take a listen.
I swear I am so tired of waiting. I'm out of patience. I'm gonna need cash in my back for the day and the crew at the station. Dream about baddies. One is Latina, the other Jamaican. That boy do not got no spirit. He faking. That boy he fake. Toss him in vacant right next to the lake. My project is fire, boy. You gotta wait. Yeah, you
and that was
wait.
A track called Modelo by a 17-year-old Madison rapper, Trapo. I see what you mean about the voice. That's a 17-year-old. That's pretty remarkable, though.
Yeah.
The sound he's got.
And like I was saying, I really appreciate the way that he approaches projects. You know, I got to interview him a few weeks ago, and he talked about how he really wants an album or an EP to have some cohesion to it and an arc and a bit of a story and not just be a bunch of songs that are stuck together.
Well, we're talking to Scott Gordon right now, editor of Tone Madison, also a WPR colleague. We're talking about the best music to come out of Wisconsin in the year 2015.
One more hip-hop artist on Scott's list you can find at WPR.org/setlist, Milo, who performed in our studios here at Vilas Hall. We'd love to hear from you. Do you have a favorite album, favorite artist in Wisconsin? Were there any great shows you went to this year? Where do you like to go to see some live music? Call in and share at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking to music writer Scott Gordon about his favorite music from Wisconsin artists in 2015.
And we want to hear from you. What are some of your favorite Wisconsin bands, past or present, or individual musicians? Did you have any new music discoveries this year? And did you see any great shows this year? Where do you like to go take in a show in Wisconsin? Call, share at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to a caller. Larry is on the line in Dubuque. Larry, hi.
Hi, thanks. I must apologize. I'm sure this song is much older, but this year was when I first heard it, and I fell in love instantly with it. And also, sadly, I don't know the title, but the chorus goes, "Oh, Agnes, won't you marry me? We'll be married in style, and we'll cross like Michigan, so blue and so wild." Does that sound familiar at all?
No, but it's a great line. I love those lyrics.
And can you put a, do you have a notion of about how old? Aren't we talking like 1930s crooner or 1960s pop?
Maybe like the 50s or
60s.
It also tells a story, and that's why I really like it too, about like a family in the apple orchard.
All right. Larry, thanks a lot for that. If your listeners have an answer to that, call in at 800-642-1234. Something about Agnes, won't you marry me? 800-642-1234 if you know that Wisconsin-related tune, I guess.
And Scott, you know, he mentioned he liked the narrative, the storytelling format. Is there anybody keeping that alive? I can think of people on the national scene who tell these long, epic stories like Josh Ritter. Anybody in Wisconsin doing that?
Oh, sure. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of songwriters and rappers and so forth who have a sense of narrative to their music. I mean, sometimes it's more overt and sometimes it's a little more fragmented. Like we were just talking about Trapo a little bit, and there's a storytelling element in what he's doing. Not necessarily one firm narrative that you can pick up on, but you kind of get little snatches of it, and that makes it interesting.
Well, I want to go to some rock and roll now. I want to hear, there's been some critical acclaim about an Appleton band, Tenement. Let's give some to listen to their song, The Butcher. I think this is on their newer album.
Across the coals, they've dragged their toes. The children that
us about Tenement from Appleton.
So Tenement has been a band for almost 10 years now, and, you know, I mean, they sort of exist a little bit off the map as far as most people are concerned, and, you know, they're a lot more likely to play DIY spaces than clubs or bars or what have you, but the, you know, people who like them and really admire their mix of sort of catchy punk songs and these more abrasive experimental tendencies. And as you were saying, that song was from a double album that they released earlier this year called Predatory Headlights. It came out on a pretty respected punk label from New Jersey called Don Giovanni Records, and a lot of people caught on to it, you know, like the New York Times and, you know, Chris Richards from the Washington Post wrote pretty glowing things about it. So a lot of people who've been following them for a long time said, oh, you know, finally people are noticing this a little more. And it's a really fun, ambitious, kind of dark and unpredictable album. And I've really enjoyed this record a lot this year.
Nice. Well, there's another one you've got here from Appleton. This is from a band called Miserable Friend. I like the name of the band. Tell us about who they are.
Well, this is a more sort of like blasted out shoegazy band. Obviously, it's also kind of dark and abrasive. It reminds me a little bit of another band from Appleton called Technicolor Teeth. But this is from an album they put out. The track that we had for them is from an album they put out this year called Thawed, Flawed, and Suffering. And I remember liking their stuff before when I checked it out in the past, but this really kind of stepped it up for me in terms of the songwriting and the kinds of atmosphere that they're creating.
I like music that's described as shoegaze, though I couldn't define it. It keeps popping up, like Lush, we were talking about the other day.
Yeah.
So it's a Miserable Friend, the band, not the friend. Yeah, I can tell right there, this is my kind of music. Scott, reminds me a little of My Bloody Valentine a little bit.
Sure, absolutely. Maybe more dark and grimy than that, but a bit of that aesthetic, yeah.
So I notice we do not have any Eau Claire on your list. Now, I think of Eau Claire as sort of the happening hotspot in Wisconsin. Before we go to a caller, no Eau Claire.
Yeah, I don't know.
Just happenstance?
There just wasn't something that really grabbed me that came out of there, not that I was like purposely neglecting it or whatever, but
well, we'll watch for it next year.
I think maybe just because of the kinds of stuff that I tend to follow, maybe it didn't favor that region quite so much.
Sure. All right, well, let's go to our caller now. We've got Tom on the line in Madison. Tom, hi.
You're going to answer a mystery for us, right, Tom? Are you there, Tom?
It's a song written by Sally Rogers about 20 years ago.
And what's the song title?
It's called Lovely Al Agnes.
Lovely Agnes.
Lovely Agnes.
That's the one that the caller was asking us about earlier.
Yeah.
Okay.
There are a whole bunch of storytelling type folk singers around and songwriters. I'm one of them. I'm going to be out at the Oregon Library doing a show tonight. And it's a genre that's definitely very big in acoustic music still. And Wisconsin is a huge, huge inspiration when it comes to those stories.
Great. Well, Tom, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate you doing that and solving our mystery.
We are talking to Scott Gordon about some of the best music to come out of Wisconsin in 2015 and answering some of our listeners' Wisconsin-related music mysteries along the way. I want to get to some electronic music before we're done, Scott. You had a couple recommendations for us. Chant, not like random chants, but CHNTS from Madison. Tell us about them.
Yeah, so Chant. It's a hymn. Chance is a project from Jordan Cohen, who is a producer and also a drummer in Madison. And we heard a little bit of him a few minutes ago on the Webster X song. He produced that track, but he also puts out his own solo records. And he put out an album this year called We Are All Underwater. And it's, you know, he's kind of classified as a bass producer, but there's a lot of this weird textural stuff going on, and the rhythms and elements that he's using are really kind of fluid, and it's not the kind of electronic music where things are really, you know, firmly locked in and super repetitive. It's a little more mysterious and a little more I don't want to say human feeling, but there is that element to
humane.
Humane?
It's probably exactly not the right word. Well, let's let the music speak for itself.
Good idea. A lot of soundscaping going on in that one. You can hear a lot just going on. You hear different textures and shapes.
Yeah, there's just a really interesting sense of space to his music, and I really enjoy it. And the voice on that song is Gentry Colello, who's a singer based in Madison, and he uses a lot of interesting guest vocalists and instrumentalists on this album in a really cool way.
Recommendation for Brian on Facebook says, not sure if they've released anything this year, but one of my favorites is Corey Chisel and the Wandering Sons. So thanks for that recommendation. You can share yours, by the way, over at the Central Time Facebook page. Scott, anything you're looking forward to in 2016 as we wrap up?
Kind of a lot. You know, I follow Madison music a lot, and there's actually like a lot of artists in Madison who have stuff coming out in January that I'm trying to stay on top of for January. So, you know, pretty excited about that. And, you know, there's always people working on things that may or may not get out soon, but there's a lot of variety, and I'm definitely looking forward to keeping up with it.
Great. Well, we look forward to having you come on and tell us about it. Scott, appreciate you stopping by.
Well, thanks a lot for having me.
That was Scott Gordon, WPR colleague of ours, and also the editor of Tone Madison. We've been talking about his favorite Wisconsin-made music of 2015.
Exciting news for Anglophiles and anyone else who's not into coffee. Today is International Tea Day. Tea seems to be one universal, even when you're the captain of the Starship Enterprise D.
Tea? Earl Grey, hot.
Brits like Captain Picard. They are super into their afternoon tea. And this is a habit, Rob, that you and I picked up, too, mostly because it can be kind of hard to talk for 2 hours on the radio every day. But if I had to choose between coffee or tea, I think that I would pick tea. My husband's going to be mad because he makes killer French press coffee, but I think I pick Earl Grey, just like Captain Picard.
I was a late convert to coffee. There's a certain level of withdrawal if I don't drink it, so I have to like it. But I got to say, I do, just on a pure taste level, enjoy coffee now more than tea. Used to be a tea guy. Now I am definitely a coffee guy, a little half and half. Adds a lot to it.
Preferably
espresso,
not moldy.
French press. Yeah, a lot of half and half's been dying in our fridge lately for me.
You could do what the late writer David Foster Wallace did, and he would steep a couple tea bags, black tea bags, in his coffee. Best of both worlds.
No, I think that would be actually the worst of both worlds. I think I will promise not to try this thing, I guess if I'm really exhausted and need to super caffeinate or something like that. No, but tea. We drink our ginger tea every day. Good, we think, we believe, psychosomatically, for the talking chords.
It works. Works for us anyway. Well, happy International Tea Day. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.